Chapter 35. The Bees, the Bees. The Danver clones had advanced a good deal since their accidental creation from the original Mrs. Danvers in Rebecca. At first, they had simply been creepy 50-something housekeepers with bad attitude. But now, they had weapons training as well. A standard Danver clone was a fearless, yet generally vapid drone who would willingly die to follow orders. But just recently, an elite force of Danver clones had arisen, with not only weaponry, but a sound working knowledge of the book world. Even I would think twice before tackling this bunch. We called them the SWAT team. The Danver clones moved in silently, with bewildering speed and a tentacle-like movement of their bony limbs. Four of them grasped my arms, while another took my shoulder bag, and a sixth removed my pistol. A seventh, who appeared to be the platoon commander, spoke briefly into a mobile footnoter phone. Target number one located and in custody. She then snapped the phone shut and used a brief series of hand signals to the other Mrs. Danvers, who began to jump out of the poem, beginning with the ones right at the back. I looked across at Colin, who was also being held tightly. A Danver clone had pulled his taxi license from his wallet and held it up in front of him, before tearing it in two and tossing the halves in the air. He glanced at me and looked severely annoyed, but not with me, more with the Danver clones and the circumstances. I was just wondering where they would take me when there was a faint crackle in the air, and my recently appointed least favourite person was standing right in front of me. She was dressed in all her black leather finery, twin automatics on her hips, and a long black greatcoat that fell to the ground. She leered at me as she appeared, and I thought about spitting in her eye, but decided against it. She was too far away, and if I'd missed, I would just have looked even more enfeebled. "Well, well," said Thursday 1-4, "the great Thursday next, finally brought to book." "Wow," I replied. "Black is surely the colour of choice today." She ignored me and continued. "Do you know, it's going to be fun being you. Senator Jobsworth has extended me all the rights that are usually yours. You in the book world, you at the CFG, you in the much-awaited and now green-lighted Thursday Next Returns. This time it's personal. And you in the Outland. That's the bit I like best. As much Landon as I want." She leaned closer and lowered her voice. "And believe me, I want a lot." I gave an almighty howl of anger and struggled to break loose from the Danvers, but without any luck. The clones all sniggered, and Thursday 1-4 smiled unpleasantly. "It's time for you to vanish, Thursday," she growled. She tossed a pair of handcuffs to the Danvers, who pulled my arms behind my back and secured them. Thursday 1-4 held on to me, took my shoulder bag from a nearby clone, and began to walk away, when the commander of the Mrs. Danvers contingent said, "I have orders to take her direct to the Ile Saint-Joseph within Papillon, as per your original plan, Ms. Next 1-4. The other me turned to the Mrs. Danvers, looked her up and down, and sneered. "You've done your job, Danny. You'll be rewarded. This is my prisoner." But Mrs. Danvers had an order, and Danvers only do one thing. They do as they're told, and until countermanded by a written order, they do it rather well. "I have my written instructions," the clone said more firmly. And the other Danvers took a menacing step towards us, three of them producing weapons from within the folds of their black dresses. "I'm countermanding your order." "No," said Mrs. Danvers. "I have my orders, and I will carry them out." "Listen here, shitface," said Thursday 1-4 with a snarl. "I'm the new Mrs. De Winter now. Get it?" Mrs. Danvers took a step back in shocked amazement. And in that short moment, Thursday 1 through 4 held tightly to my arm and jumped us both out. I was expecting a ready-dug grave, or worse, a shovel and a place for me to dig one. But there wasn't. Instead, the place where we'd arrived looked more like the sitting room of a Georgian country house of moderate means somewhere. And thankfully, there wasn't a shovel in sight. But there was a Bradshaw, five Bennett sisters, and Mr. Bennett, who were all staring at me expectantly, which was somewhat confusing.
"Ah," said Bradshaw. "Thank goodness for that. Sorry to keep you in the dark, old girl, but I knew my footnotophone was bugged. We've got to get you across to the Sea of G, but right now we have a serious and very pressing problem."
"Okay," I said slowly and in great puzzlement. I looked across at Thursday, who was rapidly divesting herself of the weapons and leather apparel. "I actually swore," she muttered unhappily, holding one of the automatics with a disdainful finger and thumb. "And these clothes made from animal skins." My mouth may have dropped open at this. "Thursday 5? I mumbled. "That's you?" She nodded shyly and shrugged. Underneath the leathers, I noticed, was her usual attire of naturally dyed cotton, crocheted sweater, and Birkenstocks. She had taken her failure over the Minotaur to heart and made good. Perhaps I'd been too hasty over her assessment.
"We knew you were in the book world, but then you disappeared off the radar," said Bradshaw. "Where have you been this past 10 hours?
I was trapped in a moral dilemma. "Any news from the Outland? I mean, are people buying into this whole reality book thing?"
"And how?" exclaimed Bradshaw. "The news from the Sea of G is that 500,000 people are waiting to see how the Bennetts will turn out, as the idea of being able to change a major classic has huge appeal. It's the latest fad in the Outland, and you know how the Outlanders like fads."
"Sometimes I think they like little else." Bradshaw looked at his watch.
"There's only 6 minutes before Pride and Prejudice, as we know it, is going to be rewritten and lost forever, and we don't have a seriously good plan of action. In fact," he added, "we don't have any plan of action."
Everyone stared at me. 20 seconds ago, I thought I was almost certainly dead. Now I was expected at short notice to fashion a plan of infinite subtlety to save one of our greatest novels from being reduced to a mind-numbing morass of transient popular entertainment. "Right," I said, as I attempted to gather my thoughts. "Lizzie?"
"Here, Mom," said the second eldest Bennett sister, bobbing respectfully.
"Fill me in. How does this reality book thing work? Have you been given any instructions?"
"We've not been told much, Mom. We are expected to collect ourselves in the house, but instead of looking for husbands and happiness, we are to undertake a preset task of an altogether curious nature. And as we do so," she added sorrowfully, "our new actions and words are indelibly burned into the new edition of our book."
I looked around the room. They were still all staring at me expectantly. "Let me see the task." She handed me a sheet of paper. It was on Interactive Book Council letterhead, and read, "Task 1. Chapters 1 to 3. 1 hour's reading time. All housemates must participate. The housemates will gather in the parlour of Longbourn and make bee costumes. After that, the housemates will be expected to act like bees. One of the housemates, dressed as a bee, will ask Mr. Bingley to organise a fancy dress costume ball where everyone is required to dress as a bee. The housemaid who is judged to have made the best bee costume and to have done the most satisfactory bee impersonation will win the first round and be allowed to put up 2 housemates for eviction. The voting Outlander public will decide who is to go. Housemates will be expected to go to the diary room and talk about whatever comes into their heads, no matter how dreary." I put down the sheet of paper. This was a good deal worse than I'd expected, and my expectations hadn't been high.
"I'm not dressing up as a bee," announced Mr. Bennet indignantly. "The very idea! You girls may indulge in such silliness, but I shall withdraw to my study."
"Father," said Lizzie, "remember we are doing this to ensure that the outland reed rates do not continue to fall in the precipitous manner that has marked their progress in recent years. It is a sacrifice, to be sure, but one that we should shoulder with determination and dignity, for the good of the book world."
"I'll dress as a bee," cried Lydia excitedly, jumping up and down. "Me too," added Kitty. "I will be the finest bee in Meryton."
"You shall not, for I shall," returned Lydia,
and they joined hands and danced around the room. I looked at Mary, who turned her eyes heavenward and returned to her book.
"Well," said Jane good-naturedly, "I shall dress as a bee if it is for the greater good. Do you suppose Mr. Bingley will also be required to dress as a bee? And whether," she added, somewhat daringly, "we might get to see each other again, as bees?"
"It doesn't state as such," replied Mr. Bennet, looking at the task again. "But I expect Mr. Bingley will be requested to make an idiot of himself in the fullness of time, and Darcy too, I should wager."
"Where's Mrs. Bennet?" I asked, having not seen her since I'd arrived.
"We had to put poor Mama in the cupboard again," explained Lizzie, pointing at a large wardrobe, which Thursday Five opened to reveal that, yes, Mrs. Bennet was indeed inside, stock still and staring with blank eyes into the middle distance.
"It calms her," explained Jane, as Thursday Five closed the wardrobe door again. "We have to commit dear Mama to the wardrobe quite often during the book."
"Yes," added Lizzie thoughtfully. "I fear she will not take to the bee task. While there are daughters unmarried, Mama has only one thing on her mind, and she is liable to get agitated and cause a dreadful scene. Do you think that will spoil the task?"
"No," I said wearily. "The worse it gets, the better reality it is, if you see what I mean."
"I'm afraid I don't."
"Thursday, old girl," interrupted Bradshaw, who'd been staring at his watch. "How's this for a suggestion? Everyone hides, so there's no book at all."
"Out of the question," intoned Mr. Bennet. "I will not hide my family from view and skulk in my own home. No, indeed. No matter how silly we may look, we shall be here in the front room when the new book begins."
"Wait a moment," I said. "This first section lasts an hour's reading time, yes?" Lizzie nodded. I took the piece of paper with the task written upon it, and pulled a pen from my top pocket, put three broad lines through the task, and started to write my own. When I had finished, I handed it to Lizzie, who looked at it thoughtfully, and then passed it to her father.
"Oh, boo!" said Lydia, crossing her arms and jutting out a lip. "And I did so want to become a bee!"
"I'm going to read this out loud," announced Mr. Bennet, "since we must all, as a family, agree to undertake this new task, or not."
He looked around at everyone, who all nodded their agreement, except Lydia and Kitty, who were poking each other, and Mrs. Bennet, who couldn't, as she was still relaxing in the closet.
"First task, chapters 1 to 3, he began. "Mr. Bennet of Longbourn House in Meryton should be encouraged by his wife to visit Mr. Bingley, who has taken up residence at nearby Netherfield Park. Mr. Bingley shall return the visit without meeting the daughters, and a ball must take place. In this ball, Mr. Bingley and Jane Bennet are to dance together. Mr. Darcy is also to attend, and he shall be considered rude, proud, and aloof by Lizzie and the rest of the family. At the same time, we are to learn much of the Bennet marriage, and their daughters and their prospects. The reading public can vote on whether Jane and Bingley are to dance a second time. Mrs. Bennet is free to do her own thing throughout." Mr. Bennet stopped reading, gave a smile, and looked around the room. "Well, my children?"
"It sounds like an excellent task," said Jane, clapping her hands together. "Lizzie?" "I confess I cannot fault it."
"Then it is agreed," opined Mr. Bennet, with a twinkle in his eye. "Truly an audacious plan, and it might just work. How long before we begin?"
47 seconds, answered Bradshaw, consulting his pocket watch.
I don't understand, said Lydia. This new task, isn't that what usually happens?
Duh, replied Kitty, making a face.
Places, everyone, said Mr. Bennet, and they all obediently sat in their allotted chairs. Lizzie, are you ready to narrate?
Yes, Father.
Good. Mary, would you let Mrs. Bennet out of the cupboard? Then we can begin.
Myself, Thursday Five, and Bradshaw scurried out into the corridor as Lizzie began the reality book show with words that rang like chimes, loud and clear, in the canon of English literature.
It is a truth universally acknowledged, we heard her say through the closed door, that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Thursday, said Bradshaw, as he, Thursday Five, and I walked to the entrance hall. We've kept this book exactly as it is, but only until the Council of Genres and the Interactive Book People find out what we've done. And then they'll be down here in a flash.
I know, I replied. So I haven't got much time to change the C of G's mind over this interactivity nonsense. Stay here and try to stall them as long as possible. It's my guess they'll let this first task run its course and do the stupid B thing for task two. Wish me luck.
I do, said Bradshaw grimly, and you're going to need it.
Here, said Thursday Five, handing me an emergency travel book in my bag. You'll need these as much as luck.
I didn't waste a moment. I opened the travel book, read the required text, and was soon back in the great library.